Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each. If you could travel back through time, where would you go? What would you see? What would you like to find out? These are the questions we will be asking guests in our new podcast for History Today magazine, Travels Through Time. My name is Peter Moore, and in each episode, I'm going to invite a different guest to take us back on a tailored tour through the past. Today's guest is the historian Dr. Diane Atkinson. Diane has written 3 biographies of remarkable, brave, pioneering women, including 2012's Criminal Conversation of Mrs. Norton, A Tale of an 18th Century Adultery Scandal, and her most recent book, Rise Up Women, The Remarkable Lives of the Suffragettes, which was published in February this year. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Diane.
Well, thank you for asking me to time travel with you. I'm absolutely thrilled about this. So
let's see where we're going to go. Well, thank you for agreeing to come with us on this tour. Soon you'll be able to bring your journey, but before you do, it's important that we map out the terms of your travel. So you're going to have to stick to the following rules. You cannot interfere with the history or participate directly in events. You are to be a silent witness, like Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, the cloaked figure in the corner, peering in, watching, eavesdropping if you like, but nothing more. You get to choose 1 year, and within that 1 year to travel to 3 different scenes. For your year, you've picked a fabulous place to start, I think, which is 1914. So can you begin by giving us a bit of a background to 1914?
Well, in terms of my story, 1914 is following on from a number of years of escalating drama and terrifying violence, which the women's suffrage campaign experienced at the hands of the general public and the police force, and also in prisons, the prison authorities. So it's a year which feels as though it's building up to something. It's an exponential rise in violence, which the suffragettes are having to kind of to soak up on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. The background is the government is absolutely determined not to give women the vote. And the suffragettes are minded to hang in there to the bitter end and not give up on their demand. So both sides are absolutely locked down in a no-surrender position. Don't forget that before we're starting 1914, 6 months earlier, the WSPU, the Women's Social and Political Union, have their first martyr. They didn't expect it. It wasn't planned by them. It was a lone action of Emily Wilding Davison, who went to the Derby to try and present to the King her argument about why women should have the vote and soon. Her protest is very well known. It makes the most famous suffragette of all. And this is the backstory to lots of copycat activities, lots of sporting facilities and other facilities being attacked and destroyed in response to Emily's sacrifice. She really causes a spike in militancy.
So you'd say that this one moment really changes the nature of the movement, really?
By that point in the campaign, it becomes deadly serious because Emily dies 4 days after her protest. Mm. She is a martyr. I'm absolutely convinced she knew there was a very good chance she would die on that day, and she went ahead knowing that was a real possibility and almost embracing that martyrdom because she'd been talking a lot about it in her letters and journalism in the weeks and months building up to June 1913. With the fact that the suffragettes have got a martyr, other women are being drafted into the movement to up their performances, up their involvement. So it's going to inspire, it's going to infuriate some women who feel this is a suicidal protest, and that can't be countenanced because, of course, suicide is illegal at that time.
This adds, I think, to the general sense of suspense. And what most people will get when they look at 1914 immediately is this feeling that we know that this is Europe on the brink of war. This is a time of deep division. television. And I suppose often, you know, it's a time that we look at as the end of a period, an end of an elegance, because we all know what is to come. And it's fascinating to think that embedded within that is this suffragette story, which you have tackled. I think this is probably a good time for you to take us to your first scene in 1914. What have you chosen?
I've chosen the drawing room of a nice house, 28 Winkley Square in Preston. It's the home of a local doctor called Dr. Charles Rigby and his wife, Edith. And it's a smart neighbourhood, but very close to a poor neighbourhood. And for many years before the suffragette campaign started, Edith has been very concerned about the lives, the working conditions, the circumstances of women who worked in the cotton industry and worked in the factories of Preston. And she's very interested in their plight. And when the Women's Social Political Union are founded, she opens a branch in Preston quite early on.
Right.
And she recruits lots of working women into the campaign. There's always been an idea that working women weren't involved or they were not really tolerated. I mean, that just isn't true at all. Edith's very keen to recruit them, to bring them to London, to pay for their train fares, and to get them involved in this quite bold and shouty style of going to Parliament to demand to see politicians. So this is the drawing room where lots of Edith's planning and conversations with her husband are going to take place.
Yeah, I was glad you picked Winkley Square. It's a square I know. It's a big, elegant, almost like the squares of London that we're very familiar in. But of course, it's in a northern town. So could you, yeah, paint the picture for us a little bit? What would you see if you were there?
It's filthy in terms of air quality.
Mm.
It's noisy. It's an industrial town. It's a powerful town. It's a very wealthy town. But the living conditions, the working conditions of the people who make that wealth are shockingly bad.
Mm.
And Edith's very concerned about the women and children in particular. And her husband is a doctor. So she's got a lot of knowledge about how these living and working circumstances are going to be undermining the health and the well-being of the people she's very concerned about, and that's women and children.
And so would Edith have been a person of some notoriety, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. Because Edith had a fantastically independent mind. She really did not give a damn about what anybody thought about her. She had that courage. She had that wonderful ability not to care and not to be a people pleaser.
Mm.
She wore sandals all year round.
Now, in that Preston. Was just
in Preston, that yeah. was dangerous and that was weird. She goes about uncorseted. Now, that's risky. And also, she chain smokes in public.
Wow. So, we're inside this drawing room with Edith.
Mm.
And what's happening on this particular day, which is the early days of January?
The early days of January 1914. Edith's not there. She's on the run from the police.
Right.
Her husband has no idea where she is. Charlie, who is one of the best suffragette husbands, I think, in the whole history of the suffragettes, he's concerned because she's been to prison for several sentences between 1907 and now, 1914. She's been on hunger strike. She's been force-fed on a large number of occasions. So as a doctor, he knows what the risks are. He will have tried to have persuaded her to just desist from that, but he knows he's not going to get any traction there, so he just lets her get on with it, but he's still upset. So the early days of January, she's on the run. He has no idea where she is because she won't write to him in case the letters are intercepted. In fact, she's in Galway, where she's been for perhaps a couple of weeks.
Mm.
She escaped from the back door of their house on a man's bicycle, dressed in man's clothing, and she disappears from Preston to Liverpool and across to Ireland. So he's wondering what the hell's going on and when is she coming back? She's not going to come back for quite some months, actually. She's not going to be back until after May, we happen to know. And he's sitting in his drawing room wondering what the hell is going on. Where is Edith? And he opens a letter from one of her school friends. And just want to read an extract from this letter that he's writing to just give you an idea about the man behind Edith Rigby. It's a difficult business, but for me, there's only one course, and that's to back Edith. I know her perfect sincerity and love of justice. She feels it to be the only course her conscience allows her to follow. She's willing to suffer blows, loss of friends, and starvation. She's almost a shadow, scarcely able to stand, with the smile of an angel and the courage of a lion. I do not have the moral courage to do what she has done. I doubt I could do it for any cause. It makes me so ashamed, and I feel so unworthy of her. And I just think that is the perfect response. That honesty, that love, that commitment, that support, and that admission that Edith is braver than him and can endure more than him. Because without a good husband, being a suffragette was really hard. Because what it was going to involve was great unpopularity, bringing a bad reputation to the house in all sorts of different ways, financial, moral.
So it almost turns on its head the old aphorism that behind every successful man is a, you know, equally successful woman. And behind every suffragette was maybe a supportive husband or family structure, at least.
Yes.
It might be interesting at this point just to talk very briefly about the consequences of the actions of suffragettes when they were taken into custody. What kind of things happened to them? What dangers was she facing? What was she escaping from?
Edith had been caught trying to burn down the Liverpool Cotton Exchange in December. And when she was caught doing that, she was actually on the run from the police. Now, I have to explain a little bit about the Cat and Mouse Act, because the Cat and Mouse Act was rushed through Parliament in 1913 to try and deal with the problem of suffragettes going on hunger strike, being force-fed, and really winning the propaganda war to some degree against the government. We'll let you starve yourselves almost to death if that's what you want. We will release you on a special licence. You have to stay at that address, and we will come and rearrest you if you're fit enough to come back to prison to carry on serving your sentence. So it's a bit like playing a game of cat and mouse. That's why it was called that. And Edith is one of many mice who is released on licence.
But this was still a new thing.
It's still a new policy. It starts in April 1913, and it's more or less running out of steam by 1913 for the following reason. Suffragettes were supposed to just sit tight at designated address, then wait to be rearrested, wait to be weighed. Well, of course, none of them were going to do that. And they didn't do that.
Yeah, I think that's just a nice twist on the familiar suffragette story, which is picturing Charlie and almost the absence of the suffragette and the fact that he's been left on his own, but he's still supporting her through letters and his emotional support as well. So that's a wonderful first scene. And I wonder if from that you can take us on to your second choice. Where should we go from Winkley Square?
Let's head down south and let's just find ourselves at Charing Cross Station. And on the 6th, Kitty Marion finds herself at Charing Cross Station, keeping an eye out for policemen or two guys who she knows have been following her around for weeks. Two guys from Special Branch, because Special Branch spent a lot of time and resources following around notorious suffragettes.
So could you tell us a little bit about Kitty?
Okay, well, Kitty is a wonderful woman. She was a music hall performer. She could sing and dance. She's a great comedian. She's been treading the boards in theatres and music halls for all of the 20th century to date. She was about 42 at this time. She'd run away from a rather miserable home life in Germany, went to live with her aunt and uncle in Walthamstow. And she has this really very vivid career, travelling around the country with troops of actors. In fact, her surrogate family, if you like, because she's run off from home. She joins the Women's Social and Political Union in 1908. Other actresses who are interested in the campaign get her involved. They say, oh, Kitty, you'd like this. You know, it's just your sort of person to be involved in this. Come and join. So she goes on a big procession in 1908 and she likes it because it's theatrical. You know, it's spectacular. And she loves all dressing up and those public moments and performances. So she joins. The tipping point for her was really all the sexual harassment she's had to experience in her working life.
Just like Red Riding Hood, she got lost in a wood, and that's how the girl lost her temper.
They've tried to get her on that casting couch so many times, and she won't do it, because she knows how insidious all of that is. So she's had a tough life. She's had a hand-to-mouth existence professionally because she isn't going to have sex or any kind of sexual contact with the agents or the theatre directors or the producers or anybody else in the business. So she's had to somehow pick her way through all the sexual politics of the theatre and the music hall. And this is the thing that takes her into suffragette campaign. She thinks, once women have the vote, we can stop all this. And we won't have sexual harassment anymore.
So there's almost a parallel here with the whole Me Too movement and the Weinstein thing.
Yes.
And she finds herself outside Charing Cross Station. What's she doing there?
She's going to meet a woman who is in charge of the prisoners at WSPU headquarters. Because there are two guys who've been hanging around Charing Cross Station looking for multiple suffragettes, because they've got photographs of these most wanted women. They know their aliases, they know their various physical features. And there happen to be two guys there who have followed her around in the past a lot, and they see her. And they go up to her and they say, hello, Katie. It's Katie, isn't it? And of course, they know it's her. Meanwhile, her friend who has come to meet her, Miss Roberts, has been making a telephone call back to headquarters. She comes back and assesses the situation and has to disappear because she can perhaps be arrested as an accessory to all of this. So it's a very dramatic scene at Charing Cross. police, who happened to be on duty anyway at Charing Cross, pick her up physically and carry her through the station. It needs 8 policemen to pile into a taxi with her to stop her kicking the internal structure of the taxi. So 8 men are used as sort of padding to go with Kitty into this taxi to be taken to the police station and charged, because she's a mouse on the run.
Ah.
She's been dodging the police. She's come to London, obviously, with plans in mind, and they've just nipped this in the bud, which is very frustrating indeed.
So this is an example, really, of how, by 1914, the suffragette movement had become a battle very much in public. You know, how much more public can we get than a railway station? Mm. And to watch that happening, of course, it makes sense of, you know, this actress and the theatricality of the moment, the kicking and the screaming. Can you explain why people were so fearful of suffragettes? Why were they that scary that they would go to these lengths to prosecute them?
Well, I think because their campaign had been so confrontational right from the beginning, they were interrupting political meetings. They were daring to stand up and say, Mr. Asquith, when are you going to give women the vote? Now, most women just didn't do that. They'd be forced to sit down. Then they'd be thrown out onto the street and they'd start a political meeting out there and they'd get arrested and go to prison. So they show a willingness to step beyond any female behaviour that anybody's familiar with. They then start to harass and really stalk politicians and spoil their weekends, ruin their holidays, spoil their visits to church. Banned from political meetings, they'll get up and have rooftop protests. And the police have to hose them down off the roof. But that doesn't stop them tearing up the slates and the tiles and raining them down on the police below.
So as you watch over the scene at Charing Cross, would you be watching with half a smile, thinking that she's actually winning here?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, as a suffragette sympathiser, I'd be concerned, but I'd be glad that she's making a good show of herself.
Mm.
But as a member of the public, I would probably be outraged and disgusted. Mm. Absolutely disgusted.
And what would the general mood be? Would they be supportive?
I think they would have been very supportive of the police.
Mm.
I think they'd be appalled and they would be encouraging the men to do what they had to. They'd be glad to see her kicking and screaming. They'd be glad to see her in sort of disarray. They'd hope that she'd get a bit of a punch. I mean, they also called them those malignant suffragettes. And I think the use of the word malignant is really interesting here. So there was very little public sympathy for them. And I think if I'd been standing there, I would have thought twice before I said, leave her alone, stop it. Because the crowd can turn on you in a minute. You're putting yourself at quite a lot of physical danger because women might attack you, not just men. Resisting the gag was almost useless, but I resisted the tube with my throat until my mouth was full of coiled tube when swallowing, which happened involuntarily sooner or later, seemed to go down in lumps and coiling as it went. When in my agony, I managed to wrench a hand free from a wardress, I would snatch the tube out, which meant a reprimand for her and repeated torture for me. I'm reading extracts from Kitty Marion's autobiography where she's talking about the process of force feeding. And this is something that she's endured on multiple prison sentences throughout her prison career.
Mm. Okay, brilliant. Well, I think we've got there a really powerful picture in, you know, this railway terminus full of trains and passengers moving to and fro, and the suffragette movement playing out in this very public forum. Take us to your third scene, please.
Well, I'd like to now go to the gates of Buckingham Palace.
Mm-hmm.
It's May the 21st, 1914, and this is the last hurrah of the WSPU in terms of political protest. There'd been a bad time in 1910, a day that became known as Black Friday, which actually tipped the movement in a much more violent position because of physical and sexual violence which women had suffered on the day. They've announced, they've told the king that they're coming to see him. He says, well, I'm not going to see you because I'm not interested. But they said, well, we're coming anyway. So 200 of them are going to march towards Buckingham Palace. There's a huge police presence. It's a great long line of policemen, ordinary constables, right in front of the palace. Altogether, there's about 5,000 police on duty that day for 200 women. A lot of the police are also going to be deployed on horses as mounted police. So this time, the suffragettes are going to go armed. And by armed, I mean with batons and with tins of paint. They're prepared to take the police on hand-to-hand fighting because they are so frustrated at the circumstances in which they find themselves.
And what route would they take? Would they go down the mountain? Because most people have an idea of Buckingham Palace, of course, a residence of the monarch in London. Presumably King George would be in there at this time.
He was in residence.
So he was in residence. So the Union Jack is fluttering.
Yes. It's supposed to be a normal day, but there's this vast police presence. The women are going to converge from different angles because they know...
And was this a planned kind of movement almost in a military sense? I know 1914 is a military year. And were they going to come as part of a plan from different directions?
They'd announced this was happening 2 or 3 weeks before it actually happened. And in fact, it wasn't just local women in London who went. There were a couple of women came from Preston. Nellie Higginson came from Preston. She wasn't with Edith this time. She had been with her before because Edith's still in Galway on the run. And other women come from different parts of London. So it's an interesting mix of suffragettes from all over the country who are going to make this journey, which they know is inherently dangerous. Because they remember Black Friday in 1910. So they're going to converge on the palace from different routes, different directions, different streets, and they're going to try and get into the palace.
So you're watching on. Tell us what happens that day.
They approach the police and the police try to push them back and they push back against the police. Some women are going to go behind the police cordon and try and climb the gates. That's not going to work. So they're going to try and tie themselves to the railing in some way, and policemen are going to drag them off and almost pull their arms out of their sockets. That's some of the photographs I've seen. It's a riot at the gates of Buckingham Palace. Women don't get anywhere near the king. They don't manage to get over the gates, but they make the most extraordinary scene, and they too experience violence on that day. And the police are also thumped and kicked and bitten and have tins of paint thrown at them. So it's a much more of a violent confrontation between the women and the police than anything the police have actually had to cope with to date. And it's been a long time since 1910. I think their procedures were a bit rusty and they can't have imagined that women would come along and be prepared to drag them off their horses.
So how important would you, or significant would you say this date is in the entire suffragette movement? Was this a moment when things really did come to a head? We've had the single scene, if you like, in Charing Cross Station before, but this seems on a scale unprecedented before. Is that right?
I would say that the location is critical because before there's been lots of run-ins with the police in Parliament Square, getting to House of Commons. That's pretty standard for them to try and get into Parliament in that way. But going to the King, which for them was a last-ditch attempt to try and break the deadlock. They said, we've tried the politicians, we've tried the newspapers, we're going to try the king. The king is our king, and we're going to beseech him and petition him to look at our case and help us. We are his subjects. We expect him to listen to us and to help us in our endeavour. And for them, there's nowhere else to go.
And so if you looked up from your place outside Buckingham Palace, would you see the king peeping through one of those Buckingham Palace windows? And if you did, what do you think he would be thinking?
I think he'd be appalled. I don't think he'd even look out of the window. Because don't forget, the last time they've had this rumble with the suffragettes has been with Emily Wilding Davis and when she spoilt their day at the Derby just a year beforehand.
And didn't the Queen write to apologise to the jockey afterwards? Is that the story?
Yes, she said, I apologise. I hope you're recovering from your injuries from that damn lunatic suffragette.
So that really encapsulates what the royals thought of the suffragette. Well, I mean, the monarch and the queen. So how did that day finish? What would happen as the sun was going down? What would the scene be like?
Well, they were heavily outnumbered, as usual, and physically picked up and thrown in the backs of Black Marias as quickly as they could. They were whizzed off to local police stations. And when the women got there, they were so angry. The rooms where they're being held before they could be formally charged, they just destroy them. They smash, they throw the furniture through the windows. They get the typewriters, it's big, heavy types. They throw those out of the window. They just smash everything they can lay their hands on. They throw bottles of ink around the room. They're so annoyed about how they're being handled. So this is happening in various police stations, not far from Buckingham Palace. The next day, when they're brought to court at Bow Street, it's hellish, really, for the authorities. It's great for the suffragettes because they're having a great time. But they won't walk into court. They have to be dragged and carried in. A lot of them won't give their names. And they're very rude and obstreperous in court. They're shouting at the magistrates all the time. They're shouting at the prosecuting solicitors. And when the sentences are being handed down to them, they almost all of them uniformly take off their shoes and pelt the magistrate with their shoes, and their purses, their handbags, their small wrist bags, they get hurled in his direction as well. So the press go to town on this. It's the most extraordinary scenes. And they're handed out quite reasonably lengthy prison sentences. Sometimes they're just prosecuted as A, or one, two, or three, because nobody has any idea who they are.
And watching on, you're seeing this in process. What's your reflection at the moment? What do you think you would be thinking? Do you think that they have got the upper hand, that they're on the way to victory? Or do you think there's still a lot to play for here? What stage do you think we're at in the story?
The government think they're looking at the end game, but of course the suffragettes have got other ideas, because what they're going to be doing increasingly is raiding their premises, their headquarters in London, perhaps arrest some of the women who are working there to disrupt, to break down morale, to hopefully get them just to give up this nonsense. So that's one strategy. You also have this situation where people who are printing the newspaper, the suffragette newspaper, the government are threatening the printers, saying, you are producing material that is conspiracy to incite violence. You know, we're going to prosecute you. And there was a prosecution. So what do the suffragettes do? They just print it in Scotland and send it back to England.
So it's not containable, this is what you're saying.
It's not containable. And it's breaking out like wildfire. They managed to pop up again.
Which started 10 years before with the creation of the party, has now gone to the very gates of Buckingham Palace. Mm. And I think that's probably a brilliant place to leave them, poised, suspended in time. We've been from the clinking cobbles of Winkley Square to the smoke-filled caverns of Charing Cross to the gates of Buckingham Palace. I think that's a pretty good travel through time. I've got a few questions for you left, though. If you could bring one object back, what would you like to bring?
Well, I'd like to bring a big leather harness which closely resembled a corset. And that's really what it was, in a way. The suffragettes always wanted to make these great speeches at sites of historic and political interest. But they had to do more than just stand there, because they could just be picked up and thrown in the back of a Black Maria and sent to the magistrate's court and then to prison. So that wasn't very satisfactory. So they got a saddler to make five of these leather harnesses, which had padlocks and chains attached. They would tie the harness around their waist and they would padlock and chain themselves to railings. 10 Downing Street, Buckingham Palace, outside Parliament. And that would give them about an hour of airtime for them to talk about the government and the government's behaviour, what's going on in prison, about anything. Mm. And they can talk for at least an hour, because it's going to take about an hour for the police, the constables, to run off somewhere, borrow a hacksaw and get them out of this padlocked harness, because they would just throw the key away. So that gave them valuable talking time and recruiting time, maybe, but just being there and untouchable for at least an hour. I'd like to have one of those souvenirs, because I think it's got huge stories attached.
Tell us a little bit more about your book. So what have you tried to do in the book, and what more can people learn about the suffragettes from your story, Rise Up Women?
Well, I'd always known quite a lot about the militancy. And then it occurred to me that I didn't really know enough about the women. What was it about their fathers? Because you had to have a supportive father or a husband to be able to persist with this. And of course, not all suffragettes did. Many of them were disowned. Many marriages collapsed. Engagements were broken off. Jobs were lost. A lot of teachers lost their jobs when their headmistresses found out they'd been to a meeting or were talking to the girls about votes, women, what does this mean or what doesn't it mean? So you'd have a huge network of support which enabled this to happen. Of course, suffragettes who were thrown out from their homes then had to find a new family, and the Women's Social and Political Union were that family. That's really the emphasis in the book, is to tell their stories, to try and explain what their story was about. And I use them, these 200 characters, to tell the story through their own engagement with the struggle.
Brilliant. I think in total you've got 200 women and 200 different biographies in this book. So it's a massive tour through the period. Thank you very much for travelling through time with us and sharing your journey with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today. And on our website, you'll find articles written by experts relating to Diane Atkinson's travels. You can read Fern Riddell on suffragettes and violence, Samita Mukherjee on the global movement for women's suffrage, and Helen Antrobus on a campaign that touched every corner of Britain. Links to all of these pieces can be found at historytoday.com/travels. And of course, there's many more articles on every aspect of the past in our monthly publication, History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine.